He says he thinks so.
And what about Hannah?
She said yes. She'll be coming.
Laurel's stomach lurches. Hannah has completely transmogrified, in her mind, from an ice princess destined never to thaw, to a scarlet woman, throwing herself at other people's boyfriends with no thought for anyone but herself. Laurel no longer knows what to think about her daughter.
Well, she says after a significant pause, that does sound lovely. I'll ask Floyd. He did say that he and Poppy usually stay in on Christmas Eve, but I'm sure they could be persuaded. Can I get back to you?
Yes, of course. Please do. But sooner rather than later, if you don't mind. I'll have to get my Waitrose order in by tomorrow at the very latest.
Waitrose orders. Laurel cannot imagine that she ever had a life that involved Waitrose orders. She puts down her phone and sighs. At Floyd's that night, Laurel asks him how Poppy had reacted when Noelle dropped her on his doorstep and disappeared into thin air. Was she happy? She says. Was she sad? Did she miss her mum? What was it like?
Well, first off, he replies, she looked awful. She was overweight, refused to let anyone brush her hair, bathe her, brush her teeth. So she was a mess. And that was basically why Noelle left her with me. She'd had this perfect little baby, and she'd totally fucked her up, because she did not know how to parent, and she'd ended up 4 years later with a monster. And no, Poppy wasn't sad. Poppy loved being here with me. When she was with me, she behaved. She didn't have tantrums. She didn't demand chocolate spread on everything. She sat, and we talked, and she learned, and she read, and when Noelle left her here, she was happy. Really happy. And of course, he shrugs. Neither of us had any idea that we would never see her again after she dumped her with me. We thought she'd be back. And by the time it was clear that she wasn't coming back, Poppy and I were a team. I genuinely don't think she's suffering because of not having Noelle in her life. I think...
He glances up at her.
I think it was a blessing.
Laurel's eyes flick to Floyd's and then away again. A thought passes through her head, so fast and so unpalatable that she is unable to keep hold of it. Poppy stands at the top of the stairs. She hangs off the banister, her head tilting at an angle, her hair swinging back and forth.
Laurel,
she says in a stage whisper.
Quick, come up.
Laurel looks at her quizzically and then says, okay.
Come in here quickly.
Poppy pulls her by the hand into her bedroom. Laurel has never been into Poppy's bedroom before. It's a small square room overlooking the garden. She has a four-poster bed with white muslin curtains, and the walls are painted white. Her duvet cover is white, and her curtains are white, with a fine grey stripe. There's a chrome lamp on her white bedside table, and white bookshelves are filled with novels.
Wow, says Laurel, stepping in. Your room is very minimal.
Yes, she replies. I like keeping it all simple. Sit, she says,
pulling out a white wooden desk chair.
Look, my Christmas present for Dad arrived. Tell me what you think.
She opens the door of a white wardrobe and pulls out an Amazon delivery box. Then she pulls out a large mug with the words, Unbearable Coffee Snob, written on it.
Oh, says Laurel. That's fabulous. He'll love it. Because he is, isn't he? He's ridiculous about coffee. You know, that stuff he has to have, otherwise he says he'd rather drink water. Grown in Ethiopia with water from angels' tears.
Laurel smiles and says yes. Lots of people are a bit weird about coffee these days, and she really can't tell the difference. And she's the same with wine. It all tastes the same to her, unless it's bad. And as she's talking, her eyes pass across the detail of Poppy's room, and she stops and clasps her chest.
Poppy, she says, getting to her feet, taking a few steps across the room. Where did you get those candlesticks?
Poppy glances up at the top shelf of her bookshelves, where a pair of chunky, geometric silver candlesticks are displayed.
I don't know, she says. They've always been there.
Laurel reaches to pick one up. It's hugely heavy in her hand, as she'd known it would be. Because they are her candlesticks. The candlesticks taken in the burglary, 4 years after Ellie disappeared. The candlesticks she's always been certain Ellie took.
I don't really like them, says Poppy. I think they were Mum's. You can have them if you like.
No, says Laurel, putting it back on the shelf, her stomach churning over and over.
No, they're yours. You keep them.
Chapter 49. Then. Ellie lay on the bed. The moon shone down on her, waxy blue. The foliage outside rustled in a sharp breeze, crackling and popping like distant fireworks. She tried to swing her legs off the bed, but they were too weak. She couldn't remember the last time she'd eaten. 6 days ago? Maybe 7? She was partway to delirium, but still aware on some subliminal, terrifying level, that she had been abandoned. She could hear her baby crying upstairs from time to time, and an ache would emanate from her heart to every point on her body. But she had no voice to call with, and no will to live. Her head was pulsing, aching, sending her strange pictures, flashes of imagery, like scenery lit up at night by strikes of lightning. She saw her mother, stirring a tea bag in a mug. She saw her father, zipping up his jacket. She saw Theo, throwing a ball for his little white dog. She saw Noelle, turning over her homework, sliding her glasses up her nose. She saw a house they'd rented in the Isle of Wight one summer. She saw the pale brown pony that stood in a field at the bottom of the garden, eating apples from their hands. She saw Poppy, lying on her back on Ellie's bed, making O's with her tiny red mouth. She saw Hannah, twirling her head around and around, her waist-length ponytail spinning above her head like a propeller. She saw her own funeral. She saw her mother crying. Her father crying. She saw the corpses of her dead hamsters sprinkled on top of her coffin like sods of earth. She saw herself floating above her coffin. She saw herself floating higher and higher. Below her, she saw her room, her sofa bed, the grimy, unwashed bedsheets, the tangled knot of duvet, the plastic cages filled with death, the bin overflowing with empty crisp packets, the blocked toilet bowl, streaked brown with rust and bacteria. She crossed her arms across her chest. She closed her eyes. She let herself float higher and higher until she could feel the clouds against her skin, until she could feel her mother's arms tight around her, her breath against her cheek. Chapter 50. When Poppy was around 2 or 3 years old, I decided to put my house on the market. You were giving me a little money here and there for her upkeep, but I was too proud to ask you for more, and, besides, it had never been about money. None of it. But I was poor then, Floyd. Like, properly poor. I could only work when Poppy was with you, and she was only with you half the time. So I decided to release some equity. We didn't need a big house on 3 floors. We'd make do in a small flat. But then, of course, I remembered the spanner in the works. That girl. That bloody girl. She'd passed over at some point. I don't know when exactly. It was for the best, I'd say. Yes, it was for the best. According to the papers, they'd scaled back the search for her. That, to me, said they had her as a runaway. So, I decided to make it look that way. I'd kept the bag she'd been carrying when she first arrived. Which shows, doesn't it, that I'd been half intending to let her go at some point. That I wasn't entirely bad. I took the keys from her bag, and when I saw the mother leaving the house with her swimming kit, I let myself in through her back door, and I took some things that I thought the girl would have taken, if she was heading out of the country. A scruffy old laptop, some cash, a pair of candlesticks that she might have wanted to sell. I'd always liked those candlesticks. They'd sat on top of the piano by the table where we worked. I'd admired them once, and the girl had said something about taking them on to the Antiques Roadshow one day to find out how much they were worth. I also took a cake. I was reminded when I saw it there of a day when the pleasant mother had brought us 2 slices of still warm chocolate cake instead of the posh biscuits, and the girl had said, "Is it one of Hannah's?" And the mother had said, "Yes, freshly baked." And the girl had turned to me and said, "My sister makes the best cakes in the world. You will never eat a better chocolate cake than this." I can't say I can particularly recall the cake or whether or not it was the best in the world. But I do remember the girl's face when she told me that. The anticipation shining in her eyes. The unabashed pleasure she took in the eating of it. It's odd, you know, because when I look back to those days when I was her tutor, I feel sure I must have dreamed the whole thing. Because by the end, I swear I had no idea what I'd ever seen in her. No idea at all. She was, after all, just a girl. I looked everywhere for her passport. The passport was the key to everything. But it could not be found for love or money. And then I had the most brilliant idea. I'd seen her sister when I'd been watching the house, and the two girls were very similar to look at. So I went to the sister's bedroom, and I found her passport in under a minute. I slipped it in the big bag with the computer and the candlesticks, and the cake in its Tupperware box. And 10 minutes later, I was home. It's hard to talk about what came next, because it did require a certain level of barbarity. I must be honest. A few years earlier, when the smell from the basement had become problematic, I had a visit from the next door neighbors shortly after she passed, asking after it. I told them it was the drains. I'd moved the girl to a blanket box in the attic. So while Poppy stayed the night at yours, I took her from there. Well, I say her. I think it would be more accurate by this stage. And I dropped her into the boot of my car, along with her rucksack, which I'd packed with the old clothes and the passport. And I drove through the dark of night to Dover. Then I found a quiet lane, deep, deep in the middle of nowhere. And I laid some of her bones down in the road, and drove my car over them. And then I dropped them into a ditch, dropped her rucksack at her side, kicked over some leaves and mud and left. Pretty sharpish. The rest of her bones I took to a municipal dump a few miles down the road. I thought she would be found almost immediately.
I'd made hardly any effort to hide her. I wanted her found.
Wanted it over.
Wanted on some subconscious level. To be caught out.
I'd barely given a thought to the forensic aspect of the thing after all. Hadn't thought about the fibers and the tire marks and the like.
But months and months passed by. And it was as though it had never happened.
It seemed I'd got away with it.
Completely.
Then the London housing market slowed down and I decided against selling my house.
Life, as it was, went back to normal.
Well, I say normal, but sweet Jesus, what was normal about living with a toddler? And this toddler was a law unto herself. A monster. All she wanted, morning, noon and night, was sugar. Sugar on her cereal, sugar on her fruit, Nutella on everything. Otherwise she wouldn't eat it. She would not go to sleep at night. And at nursery, she was mean to the other children. She'd wallop them and trip them up. I was forever being called in. And then I'd bring her to your house for her weekly stays, and she'd be, oh, the perfect little angel. All daddy this and daddy that. And at first, of course, I loved it, because she was my route back to you. And in that respect, it had worked. But then I could see the two of you forming a kind of breakaway team. It was like you and SJ all over again. She'd sit on your lap and she'd twirl your hair and she'd look across at me as if I was nothing to her. Less than nothing. I'd come to collect her from your house sometimes after you'd spent a day together and she'd hide behind your legs or hide herself in a room somewhere in the house and refuse to come out. I'm not going, she'd say. I'm staying here. And sometimes I'd think, fuck it. Fuck you both. And I'd leave. And there'd be the two of you, closing the door behind me, going back into your lovely, cozy house to do lovely things together. And she ate what you gave her. She'd come home and tell me about stir-fries and crispy prawns and stews from African restaurants. There was no sugar in your house. No junk food. No CBeebies, no cheap electronic toys that made noises that imprinted themselves onto your psyche forevermore. None of the stuff I'd given her to shut her up. Just books and music and trips to the park. Then one day, and you'll remember this day, Floyd, it was pretty significant. You told me you were thinking about homeschooling Poppy. I just filled in the forms on the internet for a place at our local primary school. But that wasn't good enough, apparently. Oh, no. Nothing was good enough for your precious Poppy. Only you, Floyd. Only you. My mini-me. That's what you used to call her. As though I literally had nothing whatsoever to do with the child. And as though only a child who mirrored you in every single respect could possibly be worth loving. Anyway, you said, she's very bright. Really very bright. I wouldn't be surprised if she was Mensa level. I don't think a mainstream school is going to know what to do with her. And if I'm going to homeschool her, it makes sense for her to come and live with me permanently. And you know, I think you thought I'd be relieved. I think you thought I'd say, okay, fabulous. Well, that's a weight off my mind. You knew how hard I found her at home. You knew how much we clashed. And you knew, deep down, that I wasn't a natural-born mother. That I wasn't a nurturer. But what you didn't know was what I'd done to get that child for you. You had no idea. You had no idea that my life was not a life, not in any real sense of the word, and that the only thing that lit the path for me was you, Floyd. And if you had full custody of Poppy, then really what was the use of me? You'd have no reason to see me anymore.
You'd have no reason to keep me on the side. I couldn't let you take Poppy. She was my ticket to you. We started that conversation like adults, and finished it in a red heat. I knew then that you wouldn't let it go. And a few weeks later, you found your moment, and you pounced. I couldn't bear to leave the house with that child half the time. She was a liability in public places. In shops, she wanted me to buy her everything. And I mean, everything. There was no shop that didn't sell something she wanted. And if I didn't get it for her, then I was mean, and I was horrible, and she'd scream the place down. So I learned to do all my errands when she was at the nursery. But that afternoon, I remembered that I needed ketchup. Not for me, mind. Oh, no. I could live without ketchup, without having an epileptic fit. But Madam couldn't. So I left her. I was gone for 10 minutes. Possibly 15. She had climbed up onto the work surface in the kitchen, looking for food. Of course, because she might die if she didn't eat something for 10 minutes. And she'd fallen and bashed her head against the corner of the unit. And there was a cut, and there was some blood, and I called the 111 number, and they told me what to look out for and when to bring her in if necessary, and I did everything right, Floyd. Everything. I behaved like a proper, decent parent. But of course, the next time she saw you, she had a huge black eye and she was all wan and bruised and, oh, Mummy went out and left me and I was hungry and I just wanted some cereal, that was all, and blah, blah, blah. And you turned to me and you said, "That's it, Noelle. That is it." And I knew what you meant. And I knew it was going to happen. So that was when I decided. Me and Poppy. We were going away. And if you wanted us back, you'd have to come and find us. I had it all planned out. I would take my bonny, brown-eyed girl back to Ireland. My mother and father would be captivated. All my brothers would say, "Well, look at the child. Sure, if she isn't the prettiest Donnelly in a generation." And after a few weeks, I'd phone you to tell you where we were, and you would get on the first plane into Dublin, and you'd see me there in the bold green light of the Emerald Isle, in the bosom of my family, our child with cheeks like rose blossoms. And I'd take you to see the perfect little village school where we went ourselves when we were small. And you'd meet my mother and father, the cleverest people I know, and my brothers with their huge brains. And you'd see the shelves in their big Victorian villa, heaving with the books and the trophies and the shields. And you'd know that I'd done the best for my child, that she was in the best place, and that you could not take her. Not now that she was so happy and so settled. Cousins all around. The sheep and the sea and the sweet meadow air. In this fantasy, you would decide to stay. You'd rent a small windswept cottage and eventually, because we were all so happy and everything was so perfect, you'd ask us to move in with you. And that was how we'd end our days. The three of us together. The perfect family.
Chapter 51. Where did Poppy get those candlesticks? The silver ones in her bedroom? Floyd looks up at Laurel from the newspaper. It's Tuesday morning and they're having breakfast. Laurel nearly didn't stay last night. She'd nearly said she had a headache and wanted to sleep in her own bed. But something kept her here. The promise of a shared bottle of wine. The proximity to Poppy. Unanswered questions.
The Art Deco ones?
Yes, on her bookshelves.
Oh, I found those at Noelle's when I went to collect Poppy's things. Lovely, aren't they?
She draws in her breath and smiles tightly. I used to have a pair, she says. Just like that.
I did wonder if they might be worth something. That's why I took them. And it was strange because Noelle literally had nothing. All her stuff. All of it. Just tat. Yet she had those. Genuine Art Deco, I'd say they were. I meant to get them valued, but I never got around to it.
Laurel keeps smiling. The pair I had were definitely worth a fair bit. Some friends bought them for us, for a wedding present. Said they'd got them at an auction. These friends were incredibly wealthy, and they suggested that we should get them insured. But we never did. She leaves that there, between them, waiting to see what Floyd does with it.
Well, there you go then,
he says, smiling tightly.
Maybe Noel did manage to leave Poppy something worth having after all.
But what about her house? Doesn't that belong to Poppy? Technically?
Noel's house? No, she didn't own her house. It was rented.
Was it? I thought... Laurel stops herself. She's not supposed to know anything about Noel's house.
I don't know, I just assumed she would have owned it. What about Noel's family? Did you ever meet them?
Did they ever meet Poppy?
No, says Floyd. Noel didn't have much of a family. Or at least not one she told me about. It's possible they were estranged. It's possible they were dead. She might have had a dozen brothers and sisters for all I know.
He sighs.
Nothing would surprise me about that woman. Nothing.
She nods, slowly digesting Floyd's lie. And when you went to her house to get Poppy's things, what was it like? Was it nice?
Floyd shudders slightly.
Grim, he says. Really grim. Cold and bare and uncomfortable. Poppy's room looked like a room in a Romanian orphanage. It had this really weird wallpaper. Everything was painted Pepto-Bismol pink. And my God, Laurel. The worst thing? The worst thing of all.
His eyes find hers, and he licks his lips.
I've never told anyone this before because it was so bleak, and so sick, and so...
He shudders again.
Depraved. But in her cellar, she had been hoarding hamsters or gerbils or something. God knows what. Mice, maybe? In cages stacked one on top of the other. Must have been about 20 of them. And a dozen in each cage. And all of them were dead. The smell. Jesus Christ.
He blinks away the memory.
I mean, seriously, what sort of woman? What sort of human?
Laurel shakes her head, widening her eyes in faux wonder.
That's horrible, she says. That really is.
Floyd sighs.
Poor sick woman, he says. Poor, poor individual.
Sounds like the only good thing she ever did was to give birth to Poppy.
He glances at her, and then down at his lap. His eyes are dark and haunted.
Yes, he says. I suppose it was.
Chapter 52. I kept you very sweet in those days after our big contretemps. I made all the right noises about Poppy coming to live with you, pretended I was giving it some thought, said that I could see the advantages. But all the while, I was painstakingly planning our escape. It was your turn to have her overnight, and I'd packed all our bags, ready for our journey to Dublin, filled the car with petrol, so we wouldn't have to stop. My mother was expecting us on the 9 a.m. ferry the following day. I thought I was so clever. I really did. But I'd underestimated you. You'd worked out what was going on. Poppy wasn't there when I came for her that evening. You'd taken her to stay at someone's house. You were ready for me.
Come in, you said. Please.
We need to talk. Were there ever four more terrifying words in the English language?
You sat me down in the kitchen. I sat in the same chair I'd used that perfect day when I first brought Poppy to meet you. I remembered how your kitchen had swallowed me up like a womb then. But that afternoon, your kitchen broke my heart. I knew what you were going to say. I knew it. I've been thinking, you said, about Poppy, about arrangements, going forward. And it can't go on like this. And to be horribly, horribly frank with you, Noelle, I fear for her, living with you. I think, here it came. Here it came. I think you're toxic. Toxic. Dear Jesus. And this is about much more than homeschooling, Noelle. This is about everything. Did you know that Poppy hates you? She's told me that. Not just once. Not just when she's cross with you. But often. She's scared of you. She doesn't. He looked up at me, eyes full of cool guilt. She doesn't like the way you smell. She said that to me. And that's not normal, Noelle. A child should not be able to differentiate between their own smell and the smell of their mother at this stage. That to me suggests a terrible, fundamental disconnect between you both. It suggests a failure to bond. And I've been talking to a social worker about what my options are. And she said that I should take Poppy out of the picture for now. Just while we thrash this out. So she's gone to stay with a friend. Just for a few days. Friend? I said cynically. What friend? You don't have any friends. It doesn't matter what friend. But we really need to reach an agreement on this, civilly, before Poppy comes home. So I'm asking you, Noelle, as Poppy's mother, could you? You struggled for the words here, I recall. Could you let her go? Please. You could still see her. Of course you could. But it would have to be under supervision. It would have to be here. And it would have to fit in with Poppy's education. I struggled for words then, too. It wasn't so much what you were saying, though that was bad enough, as the tone in which you were saying it. There was no, oh, I'm terribly sorry, Noelle, but I've passed your child on to strangers, and now I want you to fuck off away from us. There was no sense in the tone of your voice that what you were saying was anything other than entirely reasonable. Finally, I said, no. No, Floyd. I won't allow it. I want my child back. And I want her back right now. You have no right. No right whatsoever. She's my child and... You put your hand up then. You said, yes, I know that. But Noelle, you have to accept the fact that you're not strong enough to be a parent. The way you're raising her, the junk food and the TV on all day, and the lack of physical affection. Not to mention leaving her alone in the house, Noelle. It's verging on abuse. And that's exactly how a team of social workers would see it. Poppy's teeth are appalling. She has nits half the time that you simply don't deal with. You're not well. In the head, Noelle. You're not well. And you're not fit to be a parent. And there it was. The defining moment of all the defining moments. Everything in my head splintered. I saw that girl's bones laid out in front of me on a dark road in Dover.
my headlights shining over the bumps of them, my foot against the gas pedal. I thought of what I'd allowed myself to become. For you. I never wanted that bloody child. I only wanted you. And I looked at you then, so calm and reasonable. And I knew you hated me, and you wanted me gone. And I wanted to hurt you. I wanted to really hurt you. So I said to you, "What makes you so sure she's your child, Floyd? Did you never wonder why she looks so little like either of us?"
Your face was worth the horror of me showing myself to you. It really was.
"She doesn't belong to either of us, Floyd," I said, feeling the twist of my words into your heart. "I made her for you, with another woman's womb and another man's sperm." The words were falling from me uncontrollably. I'd nothing left to lose. "She's a Frankenstein monster, Floyd. That child you so adore. She's barely human, in fact." "Noelle, I don't."
I spoke over you, desperate to answer your questions before you asked them, desperate to take control.
"A girl called Ellie had that baby for me. I was never pregnant, you dumb idiot. How could you have thought I was, with your big, brilliant brain? Ellie had that baby. She was the mother. And the father was some stranger on the internet, selling his sperm for £50 a shot."
"Oh, come on now, Floyd. You didn't honestly think that child could be yours, did you? That glorious, golden thing. That she could be formed from your tired old genes.
Really? Didn't you wonder? Didn't you think?"
"No, Floyd. Poppy's father was a young, young man. A PhD student. The website I bought his sperm from said he was under 30. That he was 6'1" with green eyes and dark hair. I pictured Ellie's boyfriend when I picked him out. I pictured Theo. And then I came to you, in my satin shirt and high heels, and seduced you in a way that you'd be sure to remember. The whole thing was a total scam, Floyd. And you fell for it. You feckless, bollockless, soulless shit. You totally fell for it."
"Well, you can keep her, you scumbag. Keep her and pay for her and know for the rest of your life, every time you look at her, that she's nothing but a big bag of cells and other people's DNA. Good luck to you both. I had my handbag by its strap. I was done. It was over. The splinters in my head were spinning so fast and so wildly, I could barely remember my own name. But I felt euphoric. And then I watched your face turn to stormy skies. Saw your skin color change from gray to seething purple. You leapt to your feet. Then you threw yourself bodily across the table at me. You had your hands at my throat, and my chair tumbled backward with me still in it. My head hit the floor, and by God, I thought you meant to kill me. By God, I really, really did."
Chapter 53. Laurel drives past Hannah's flat on her way from Floyd's to work that morning. She's hoping for a sneaky glimpse of Theo and Hannah leaving for work together. But it's dark and quiet, and at least now Laurel can picture where her daughter has been. She has been in Theo Goodman's bed. Theo is a schoolteacher now. Hannah had told her that, funnily enough, about a year ago. Said she'd bumped into him somewhere or other. Laurel couldn't really remember the details. That must have been when it started, she supposed. Laurel is unfairly horrified by this twist in the fabric of things. Theo was Ellie's. He'd belonged to her, and she'd belonged to him. They'd inhabited each other completely, like a pair of gloves folded into itself.
And now she is cross with Hannah. Cross enough to wonder what Theo even sees in Hannah, in comparison to Ellie. She imagines, in the warped threads of her irrational thought processes, that Theo chose Hannah as a consolation prize. But then she remembers seeing that blonde girl coming out of the supermarket on Sunday morning. That smiling, golden girl who looked nothing like the sour-faced girl who greets Laurel at her door from time to time. The pinched child who never laughs at her jokes. The tired-looking woman who sighs down the phone at the sound of her mother's voice. And it occurs to her, for the very first time, that maybe Hannah isn't intrinsically unhappy. That maybe she just doesn't like her. She calls Paul later that afternoon. He's at work and she can hear the warm rumble of normality in the background. "Listen," she says. "Can I ask you something? About Hannah?" There's a beat of silence before Paul says,
"Yes."
"He knows," thinks Laurel. "He already knows." "Has she said anything to you about a boyfriend?" There's another silence.
"Yes, she has."
She exhales. "How long have you known?"
"A few months,"
he replies. "And you know? You know who it is?"
"Yes. Yes, I do."
Laurel closes her eyes. "And she told you not to tell me?"
"Yes. Something like that."
Now Laurel pauses. "Paul," she says after a moment, "do you think that Hannah hates me?"
"What? No, of course she doesn't hate you. Hannah doesn't hate anyone. Why would you say that?"
"It's just, whenever we're together, she's so spiky and cold. And I've always put it down to arrested development. You know, losing Ellie when she was just on the cusp of adult life. But I saw her the other day with Theo, and she was so bright and so happy. She looked like a completely different person."
"Well, yes. She is madly in love, by all accounts."
"But when she's with you, and Bonnie, what's she like then? Is she light-hearted? Is she fun?"
"Yes. I'd say she is, on the whole."
"So I'm right, you see. It is me. She can't stand being with me."
"I'm sure that's not true."
"It is true, Paul. You've never seen it. You've never seen what she's like with me when it's just the two of us. She's like a void. There's nothing there. Just this blank stare. What did I do, Paul? What did I do wrong?" She hears Paul take a breath.
"Nothing," he says. "You did nothing wrong. But I'd say, well, it wasn't just Ellie she lost, was it? It was you, too."
"Me?"
"Yes, you. You went kind of off radar. You stopped cooking. You stopped being a parent."
"I know, Paul. I know I did. And I've apologized to Hannah a million times for the way I was then. Why do you think I go to her house every week and clean it for her? I try so hard with her, Paul. I try all the time, and it makes no difference."
"Laurel," he says carefully, "I think what Hannah really needs from you is your forgiveness."
"Forgiveness?" she echoes. "Forgiveness for what?" There is a long moment of silence as Paul forms his response.
"Forgiveness," he says finally, "for not being Ellie."
Paul's words have unfurled a whole roll of thoughts and feelings that Laurel hadn't known were so tightly wound inside her, and she is plunged straight back into the minutes and hours following Ellie's disappearance,
recalling the sour resentment at being left with Hannah, denying her the lasagna that Ellie had staked her claim on, as Ellie had staked her claim on so much in their family. Everyone had fought for Ellie's attention, for a blast of her golden light. Then the light had gone, and they'd dissipated like Death Stars falling away from the sun. And yes, Laurel had never accepted Hannah as a consolation prize. She really hadn't. And as a result, she'd got the relationship with her daughter that she deserved. Well, now she knows this. She can work on it and make things better. Laurel calls Hannah. It goes through to voicemail, as she'd known it would. But this can't wait another moment. She needs to say it right now. Darling, she says, I just wanted to say, I am so proud of you. You are the most extraordinary girl in the world, and I am so lucky to have you in my life. And I also wanted to say that I'm sorry. So sorry if anything I've ever done has made you feel like less than the center of my world. Because you are. You are absolutely the center of my world, and I could not live without you. And, she draws in her breath slightly, I wanted to say that I saw you the other day. I saw you with Theo. And I think it's wonderful, and I think he's a very, very lucky man. A very lucky man indeed. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say, and I'm sorry I haven't said it before, and I love you. And I'll see you on Christmas Eve. I love you. Bye. She turns off her phone, and she rests it on the kitchen counter, and feels a wave of relief and weightlessness pass through her. She is unburdened of something she hadn't even known she was carrying. Chapter 54. When Laurel arrives at Floyd's house that evening, she feels lighter, more present, in the moment. And she notices for the first time that although there are only 3 days till Christmas, there is no tree in the house. In fact, there are no decorations of any kind. Do you not do Christmas trees? She asks, as Floyd helps her off with her coat in the hallway.
Do Christmas trees?
Yes. Do you not put one up?
No,
he says.
Well, we used to, but we haven't for years. But we can if you want one. Do you want one? I'll go and get one now.
She laughs. I was thinking more of Poppy, she says.
Pops, he calls up the stairs. Would you like a Christmas tree?
They hear her footsteps, loud and fast. She appears at the top of the stairs and says,
Yes.
Yes, please.
Right then, says Floyd.
That's settled then. I will go out now like a proper father, and I will bring home the mother of all Christmas trees. Want to come with me, Pops?
Yes.
Let me just get my shoes on.
We'll need fairy lights, says Laurel, and baubles. Have you got any?
Yes. Yes, we do, in the attic. We always had a tree when Kate and Sarah lived here. There's boxes of the stuff up there. Let me go and get it.
He bounds up the stairs two at a time and returns a few minutes later with two large paper shopping bags full of tree decorations. Then he and Poppy get into the car and disappear into the dark night together. And Laurel looks around and realizes that she is alone in Floyd's house for the very first time. She turns on the TV and finds a satellite channel that is playing Christmas songs. Then she pulls some things from the bags. Random is the word she'd use to describe them. Scuffed plastic balls, a knitted reindeer with three legs, a huge, spiky snowflake that snags a hole in her jumper, stern-faced wooden soldiers, and a group of slightly alternative-looking wood nymphs in pointy hats with curled toes on their shoes. She leaves them in the bag and takes out the fairy lights.
There are two sets, one multicolored and the other white. The white ones work when she plugs them in at the wall. The multicolored ones don't. She goes through some of the drawers in the kitchen, looking for a spare fuse. She looks in the drawers in the console table in the hallway. Takeaway menus, parking permits, spare keys, a roll of garden refuse bags. But no fuses. Then she looks at the door to Floyd's study. This is where he and Poppy do their home learning together, where he writes his books and his papers. In her own version of this house, they'd knock through from the front to the back to make a double reception. But Floyd has left the two rooms separate, as they would have been in Victorian times. She hasn't been in Floyd's study yet, just viewed it fleetingly as he's walked in or out. She feels quite strongly, although she's not sure why, that Floyd would not want her in his study without his permission. So she stands for a moment or two, her hand on the doorknob, persuading herself that it is just another room in the house, that Floyd cannot live without her, that of course she can go into his study to look for fuses. She turns the handle. The door opens. Floyd's study is well furnished and cozy. The floorboards are covered over with threadbare kilims. The furniture is solid and old. There are two chrome table lamps with arc necks, one with a green glass shade, the other white. A laptop is open on his desk, showing a screensaver of changing landscapes. She quickly starts to sift through his drawers. Pens, notebooks, foreign coins, computer disks, CDs, memory sticks, everything organized in internal compartments. She goes to another desk, one that sits by the back window overlooking the garden. Here, the drawers are locked. She sighs and absent-mindedly rifles through the piles of paper that sit on top of the desk. She is no longer looking for a fuse. She knows that. She's looking for something to snap her out of the strange fog that she's been trapped in for the past few days. And suddenly, she has it in her hands. A pile of newspaper cuttings, all from around the time of the Crime Watch appeal on May 26. There's her face, there's Paul, and there's Ellie. There's the interview she did for The Guardian, and the interview she and Paul did together in the local paper. She remembers Floyd in his kitchen, coyly confessing to having Googled her after their first date. Yet 6 months earlier, before he'd even met her, he'd been tearing out and collecting newspaper cuttings about Ellie's disappearance. She slots the cuttings back into the pile of paperwork at the sound of a car door closing on the street outside, and quickly leaves Floyd's study. Floyd and Poppy return a moment later. They have bought an 8-foot tree. "Well," says Floyd, his cheeks flushed pink with the effort of getting it into the house, balancing it on its stump briefly so that Laurel can appreciate its great height. "Will this fulfill the brief?" "Wow," says Laurel, pressing herself against the wall so that Floyd can negotiate it through the hallway and into the sitting room. "That is a tree and a half. We're going to need more lights."
"Ta-da!"
Poppy appears behind him, clutching bags from a DIY store full of fairy lights. "Brilliant," says Laurel.
"You thought of everything."
The TV is still tuned into Christmas songs. "Stop the Cavalry" by Jonah Louie is playing. Floyd cuts the netting around the tree, and they all watch as the branches spring free. Floyd is strangely overexcited about the tree. "Hey," he says, turning to Poppy and Laurel. "It's a good one, huh? I got a good one." They both assure him that it is a good one. Then Poppy and Laurel begin to dress the tree, while Floyd goes to the kitchen to prepare supper.
"So you don't normally bother with a tree?" Laurel asks.
"No," says Poppy. "I don't really know why. We're just not a Christmassy kind of family, I guess."
"But Sarah Jade and her mum, they do a tree."
"Yes."
Poppy's eyes light up.
"Kate is mad about Christmas. Totally nuts about it. Their house looks like a Christmas card."
she catches herself. It's a bit much, really, she finishes. Sounds lovely to me. Poppy smiles then and says,
Will there be a tree at Bonnie's house on Christmas Eve?
Oh, God, yes. I'm sure there will be. Definitely. A big one, probably. Poppy smiles broadly.
I can't wait, she says. It'll be nice to have a proper Christmas for a change.
What do you normally do on Christmas Day?
Nothing much, really. Have lunch, swap presents, watch a movie.
Just the two of you? Poppy nods. You don't see family?
I haven't got a family.
You've got SJ.
Yes, but she's just one person. I mean, like a whole big family. Like yours. I sometimes wish...
She glances toward the sitting room door and then lowers her voice.
I love being with Dad, but I sometimes wish there was more.
More what? Poppy shrugs.
More people, I suppose. More noise.
They take a step back from the tree a while later, just as Fairy Tale of New York comes on the TV. The tree is fully dressed, and Laurel has switched on the fairy lights. Floyd comes in and gasps.
Ladies,
he says, putting an arm around each of their shoulders.
That is a triumph. An absolute triumph.
He turns off the overhead lights and then turns back to the tree.
Wow. Just look at it.
The three of them stand like that for a moment or two, the Pogues playing in the background, the lights on the tree flashing on and off. Floyd's arm is heavy across Laurel's shoulders, and she feels him tremble slightly. She looks up at him and sees that he is crying. A single tear rolls down his cheek, a thousand tiny Christmas lights refracted through it. He wipes it away and then smiles down at Laurel.
Thank you, he said. I didn't know how much I wanted a Christmas tree this year.
He leans down and kisses the crown of her head.
You, he said, have made everything perfect. I love you, Laurel. I really do.
She stares at him in surprise.
Not that he has said it, but that he has said it in front of Poppy.
She glances quickly at Poppy to gauge her reaction. She is smiling at Laurel, willing her to complete the moment. She has no idea how hard this is for Laurel. But they are both gazing at her, waiting for her to give them something. And it is Christmas, and it is dark, and for some reason, Laurel feels that she must do this, that it is hugely important in some strangely sinister way she can't quite define. And so she smiles and says,
And I love you both, too.
Poppy pulls Laurel into a hug. Floyd follows suit. They hold each other for a moment or two, the three of them, the heat of their combined breath, meeting in the heart of the embrace. Eventually, they pull apart and Floyd smiles at Laurel and says,
That's all I want for Christmas. That's all I want. Full stop.
Laurel smiles tightly. She thinks of the press cuttings on Floyd's desk. She thinks of the carrot cake they'd shared in that cafe near her hairdresser. The overpowering certainty of him as he'd walked in the door and found his way to her. And then she thinks of the phone call from Blue. Your boyfriend, his aura, is all wrong. It's dark. And she feels it, right there and then, stark and obvious. Something askew. Something awry. You're not who you say you are, she suddenly thinks. You're a fake.
Chapter 55 Laurel's mother is still alive when Laurel pops in to see her the next day on her way to work.
Still here, then?
She asks, pulling her chair closer to her mother's. Ruby rolls her eyes. You know it's Christmas Day on Friday, she says. You can't go and die before Christmas and ruin it for everyone. You do know that? If you were going to